it's, you know, like sheep.
Yes.
I know the answer.
I don't think that will be necessary. Okay, we ready?
Sure.
Sure.
Yep.
Okay, Sean Daly here, reporting for Groklaw. I'm here in Luxembourg, just across the street from the European Court of Justice, the Court of First Instance. And I'm seated with four people whose point of view could be interesting to you. Perhaps each of you could introduce yourselves and talk a little bit about what you've been doing on this case.
Yeah, my name is Volker Lendecker. I'm a member of the Samba team. I'm based in Germany with a company called Zenit doing Samba business. And I've been at several occasions here for hearings presenting our point of view, supporting the commission.
My name is Georg Reber. I'm president of the Free Software Foundation Europe. And my job was more or less to help, you know, keep things together, make sure the word gets out, do a bit of the coordination, and be as supportive as I can to the brilliant team that's been working on this case.
My name is Carlo Piana. I'm the lawyer on records for these guys, so I'm basically doing the legal stuff.
And I'm Jeremy Allison, and Carlo's been too modest. He's the one who actually wrote most of the briefs that went in. So he bears a direct responsibility for this result. I'm a co-author of Samba. I've been working on this case along with Volker since the beginning. I took a 2-year hiatus while I was working for Novell, but I'm now back on the case, and I work for Google. And the missing person in the room who really should be here but can't be with us today is Andrew Tridgell from Australia, who is the original creator of Samba. And he did a fantastic job in the previous hearing, along with Carlo and Jorg. And unfortunately, as he lives in Australia, he can't be with us here today. But he's with us in spirit.
And sorely missed.
Truly. Yes, truly missed, yeah.
Well, I'm sure we're thinking of him, because I remember the very first time that I interviewed Jorg was here in Luxembourg during the previous week of hearings. And Jorg had mentioned at that time how effective Tridge's testimony was during the hearings.
Tridge is one of the few people in the world who really do understand the technology better than almost anybody and can communicate that knowledge. He is a marvelous teacher and communicator, and he was the needle that made the blue bubble theory burst.
He's also able to actually understand legal issues.
Yes.
And read through legal text and understand the consequences. And this is a combination, unique combination.
Yeah.
And I was impressed by his moral integrity, which is a rare match in this.
Now, tell me a little bit more about the blue bubble, because I wasn't present at the hearings, but, you know, in the hallway coming out of the hearing, I just kept hearing about this blue bubble bursting. What's going on here?
Well, the blue bubble was a theory that Microsoft invented in order to justify that it had kept parts of the protocol secret. They said that there's a difference between, you know, the internal protocols and the external protocols, if you want to describe them like that. They said there's certain protocols that are so secret that they are in this blue bubble, because they had visualized this with a blue bubble, that this could never be shared without actually sharing source code, without sharing, you know, how the program exactly works. You know, these protocols were so special that somehow, magically, you know, you had to have the same source code to actually make that work. That was the blue bubble theory. So they said, oh, things like, you know, HTML is outside the blue bubble, but the things you want us to disclose, that is inside the blue bubble.
In one of the hearings, the bubble was actually green, I think.
they had many bubbles, but they redefined them too. Yeah. The bubble at some point, I think, was also between, you know, they made a bubble distinction between the servers
and the server-client
protocols as well. So they had different bubbles throughout the case.
Yeah, basically the bubble has shrunk, because initially everything was in the blue bubble. And then when this case was smashed down by Jeremy, by Volker and Tridgell, they tried to salvage a part of it. So to salvage the theory, they said, okay, you're right on this part, but on this part we were still right.
So it was a deflating balloon, and then Tridge actually popped it entirely.
Yeah. Exactly. Tridge popped the blue bubble extremely effectively.
So it was a very, very late submission of Microsoft, actually at the hearing. We haven't heard of it before. It was presented at the hearing, and Twitter was dramatically effective in disrupting it and saying, this is rubbish.
Well, I remember, Jörg, I think you had said that he had held up a little prototype of like a network-aware disk drive or something.
Well, basically, one of the questions the court asked is forcing Microsoft to release part of their communication protocols, one of the requirements is to have to show that a new product has been
would be possible.
Yeah, a new product could be created. Yes. Yeah, what new markets and would so, be created.
Exactly. And Twitter shown up this $100 piece of hardware, which could be, with Samba 4, an active domain controller for $100, which is, it would be
cheaper,
terrible achievement for technology. And that's what the reason why.
Yeah, you ended up, they were interesting, the hearings. What would happen is that you would end up having to think on your feet in the courtroom, which is kind of interesting. It's a different challenge from programming. You have to watch and understand the presentation from the other side, and you have to be able to adapt to your arguments when it's your turn to stand up and rebut it. So it's a very interesting, it's more like a debating technique. But it's a lot of fun, actually.
No, I have to say, the Samba team members have been incredibly good at this. I mean, Jeremy deserves the credit for the interim measures case, you know, the question whether or not Microsoft should get more time to implement these things. And, you know, both Jeremy and Tridge are very good at thinking on their feet, I have to say.
Now, Carlo, you've had about 1 hour to read through all 258 pages. So I know you know the entire. I'm joking. What is your first reaction to the ruling? Do you think that it will really stop Microsoft from what they've been doing to the market?
Well, it's still very early to assess that. I haven't had much time to read through it, but I've concentrated on a couple of points. I must say that the decision is very very direct and. It speaks loudly against Microsoft's case very much. This doesn't mean that Microsoft is now forced to comply, because the decision is one thing, to actually receive the information is another thing. But I think that the legal points that the decision has have made are very good for the follow-up, which is more important, actually, than what we have done. So we have achieved the first victory. The future will bring.
Actually, I think we won the second round. No, the first round was the third measures.
This is true. Yeah. Yes.
But I easily forget victories, and I will like very much to focus on what's ahead, which is a lot of job, a lot of work.
Now, a phrase that I've read in the news is that appeals are possible above the Court of First Instance to the European Court of Justice, but only on points of law and not in the facts of the case. Can you explain that for a minute?
Yeah. Already this is an appeal against the Commission decision. So the extent to which the Court could dig into the facts finding of the Commission is relatively narrow. Now the appeals on this decision are going to be strictly on the point of law. So if the court has cited correctly the case law or done something manifestly wrong and stuff like this. So the scope of the appeal is very narrow now. So I don't think they will have much leverage on what's going on. And I don't think Microsoft will count very much on the Court of Justice. They will try to squeeze out. There are ways they can squeeze out the decision. For instance, they are still able to claim that their quote-unquote intellectual property rights must be taken into consideration when for instance, handing out information to Samba. because they say, no, we cannot do it because we will give away our secret. And our secret is intellectual property, and so, sorry, we cannot. This one way, I anticipate it will work very hard.
When they say intellectual property, very often it's not clear at all if they're talking about copyrights or patents or what.
And this is so deliberate.
They had a theory that which they tried floating in previous arguments, that basically specifying the protocols was the same as giving away the source code. So they were actually trying to establish that specifying the protocol would be a copyright violation for anyone else to implement it, which didn't fly, because I think that's not being a lawyer, I think that's just silly.
One key word for them in the proceedings was the word clone.
Oh, clone and projects.
This is exactly what we do not want to do. We do not want to clone their products.
So
we want to implement a separate implementation of their protocols.
So the very interesting thing about the term clone projects is that if you look at the agreements that Microsoft have done with companies like Novell and probably Zandros and Linspire, I've only seen the Novell agreements, I haven't seen the Zandros and Linspire ones. The Novell ones are public, by the way. You will find that they explicitly exclude what Microsoft call in their legal documents clone products, which I think they include Samba among. So yeah, there's this whole theory that they're trying to set up that Samba is a clone of Windows and therefore is not available for protection. The interesting thing about the licensing is that I think what Microsoft will try and do, I believe that this might have been what some of the discussions with the Commission have already been about, is that what they've tried to do is to say, look, we have a licensing program already that we implemented in the US for the Department of Justice case, and that's the MCPP, Microsoft Communications Protocol Program, licensing program. And what they were trying to do was to say, well, why don't we just extend that to cover the server-to-server stuff, and then we'll adopt that in the EU, and then let's settle the case. The problem with the MCPP is that it's an abject failure, in that if you look at the companies that have licensed under that program, and the license terms are explicitly designed to exclude free software. So they're designed so that there's a per royalty basis, there's a time limit on the implementation's validity, I think it's about 5 years, there's royalties, there's all sorts of...
There's per seat licenses.
Yeah, there's per seat licenses, yeah, thanks Walker. There's all sorts of methods to make this completely unusable in a free software implementation.
I mean, which is the same trick they're trying permanently.
Yes.
I mean, ultimately, I mean, the good part about the reason why I think that actually is not no longer a feasible option even to suggest is the fact that we have by now the conclusion that the remedies in the U.S. were entirely ineffective.
Yes.
I mean, there was just recently, people investigated this and found out the remedies had no effect whatsoever. Therefore, I think we can safely say that those licensing terms don't help at all. But they've tried it also, by modifying those kind of concepts in the same way, because when you think about it, I mean, they should have published those protocols long ago. I mean, after the first, after the inter-measures case, ultimately, they were obliged to publish, but they didn't. They always tried to come up with new ways to delay, to obfuscate, and to make it legally impossible to implement. I mean, they realize that Samba is the only competitor left. So, in a way, what they're now trying to do is to say, we will give our information to competitors, but only to those who don't actually compete with us.
So the interesting thing, Brad Smith gave a statement just after the judgment was announced, where he talked about how Microsoft was, I think the industry had changed and Microsoft was doing deals with Sun. Sun had now become a Windows OEM and they had the Novell deal, etc. What he didn't say was that both Sun and Novell, their workgroup server implementation is Samba, which has been explicitly excluded from the agreements that they've done with Novell. And IBM's workgroup server implementation is Samba, and Apple's workgroup server implementation is Samba. And, you go into Fry's Electronics in the US, and any sub-$5,000 NAS box you will find in that place is Samba. So, essentially, anyone who actually really competes with them has been excluded from these agreements.
So if I can ask a silly question, Microsoft usually gets their way by showing up with a suitcase full of cash and making a deal. I mean, how much they offered, how many millions of dollars to Real Networks to leave the case? Haven't they ever...
What,
come to you?
They obviously didn't offer us enough. No. Sorry. Sorry, Joe. Well, the issue is, you see, the thing you've got to realize about free software, or especially something like Samba, is that we don't own it.
Right.
I mean Volk and I don't...
Even if they bought us out,
yes,
the software would be out there. I mean, we have copyright on it, and we protect our copyright, but anybody could take it, build upon it, and just extend it. And so,
and the copyright in Samba is spread across, you know, many, many different individuals, all of whom contributed under the GNU GPL v2 or later, now GPL v3 or later, licenses. And so you can't buy that. There's nothing to sell. There's no point of agreement for which to say, okay, here are the rights to Samba, we'll go away. I mean, you know, so... were in the, some would say unique, some would say certainly unenviable position of not being able to sell out. Yeah. We can't be bored.
Plus, I mean, on an organizational level, I mean, yes, they did try to buy everyone out of the case that they could, and they spent...
And they were really, pretty successful.
They spent remarkable money on this. I mean, more than...
Billions of dollars.
3.6 billion, I think, is the final count at some point. Mm. You know, for Sun, for Novell, for Real, for the CCIA. I mean, they were all bought out of the case.
A billion there, a billion here, a billion there. Soon you're talking about real money.
Yeah.
And much of the evidence was... taken out of the case because Real Networks, which was one of the initial complainants, withdrew. So their submission we are relied upon all along the case, was withdrawn just before the case came to an end.
Yep.
So the case was lame at some point, just because one of the parties was bought out.
It did get a little lonely for us.
It certainly did,
I have to say. I mean, we were feeling a little bit left alone, but it does speak for their sense of realism that they didn't actually try to buy us out because
well,
it doesn't work.
Because we wouldn't sell, yes.
Yeah.
Well, I know, Jeremy, that the time of the Novell deal was a difficult time for you, and that you made a choice which I think is very well respected throughout the community. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, so the agreement that Novell did with Microsoft to pull out of the case, actually that wasn't. I was at Novell after Novell agreed to pull out of the case. And essentially, I was okay with that. I wasn't happy about it. I understood why it was done financially, and you know, others were continuing the case. But the agreement about essentially admitting that Linux, the admission that was made that Microsoft then trumpeted that Linux was violating patents, that was a little too much for me. So that was what ended up making me leave. I've already spoken about that, really. I mean, that was kind of an orthogonal position to the case, but I think it shows that Microsoft's adaptability. I mean, their new strategy, it appears to be, is to say, okay, you know, we may lose this case, we may have to give out the interoperability into information, but did we happen to mention it's all covered by these patents? Oh, which we're not going to tell you what they are, by the way.
Which would be very disastrous for them in Europe, in Germany. I mean, all these Linux violates 200 and whatever patents.
Yeah, it's meaningless here.
You would never see this on Microsoft.de, because, as I understand German patent law, is once you make this statement, you have to say what the patents actually are.
Right.
And so you would never see this statement from a German Microsoft representative.
Yeah, although my favorite patent involved in the whole damn thing was when they said that they had all this documentation about how all of this worked, like the interoperability information, but these were like, I don't know, what was that, 64,000 pages or something, like an insane amount of pages, apparently, necessary to generate that specification. They said, oh, and by the way, I mean, we don't think anybody can read this unless they have sorted it in the right way, and there was a special sorting for this information, and by the way, that method, we've patented it. So, you know, if you want to read that, you know, you have to get the patent license on the method
in order
to sort
read
the information.
Well, you know, that reminds me of the documentation that was requested by the European Commission, and which Microsoft, instead of delivering to the European Commission, made available at the entrance of their headquarters in Redmond. And as it turned out, they were on password-protected disks, and Microsoft had asked the members of the EC, the monitoring trustee, and the others, to sign a special license in order to use the special software in order to access the documentation.
That's classic. That's straight out of the Microsoft Communications Protocol Program. I mean, yeah. So Dennis Chapman from NetApp, who is a licensee. Did you want to say that? Okay, sorry. So Dennis Chapman gave a talk at one of the CIS conferences where he actually covered what you got when you signed the MCPP programs and how useful it was. And one of the things he actually talked about was the only way you can read the documentation is by using special password-protected Microsoft software on certain registered machines with all sorts of, you know...
No way to print stuff.
No, you can't print stuff, you can't search in it.
It's just a pain.
Yeah, it was very difficult to use.
The devil is in the details with these things because, yes. I mean, you know...
Although, to be honest, Dennis also said they fixed that later on. That was in the first versions. I think he said that he got claims protected PDFs now, but...
So maybe that... Yeah. But it does sound like a classic thing out of the MCPP playbook.
All right, well, I know that all of you have worked quite hard over these past few months or even years... a question really for each of you. Has it been worth it?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Not for the result alone, but for learning how these things work and having good success after having spent several months working that is... I mean, that's just a bonus after it. But it was very interesting to see how these things tend to work. I'm a European... And I didn't know before what the procedures in this kind of case are actually. And so, I mean, learning this has been very interesting. So definitely worth it.
It was definitely worth it. But we must put more effort in it because we must secure the result. This is the message I want you to bring home. Because... the result is so much important for the whole software industry that cannot be just a decision, which is already a good thing, but it's not enough.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, it's been a lot of fun, for a strange definition of fun, but it really is a lot of fun. It's hard to describe. I think maybe some of the people who were following the SCO court case for Grok Law have realised how much fun the law can actually be, how interesting it is, especially from someone who's used to programming code, sort of watching people sort of program in the language is very, very interesting to do.
Jeremy, do you remember one of the lawyers actually saying, oh, you could do my job, I couldn't do yours?
Yeah, that was probably one of the highest compliments I got from
after giving one of your talks in the...
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. I mean, we haven't won yet because they still haven't released the information
in a way
that's actually usable. But the other thing is, it really should inspire people, I think, in that essentially this is a case where the little guys won. Now, I know it's hard to think of the EU as the little guys, you know, I mean...
Or IBM or Google.
Yeah, or IBM or Google, but really... To be honest, they really haven't. All of the big guys, all of the firms, you know, all of the corporations. Essentially, they. Give you an example. I was sat in Before this case started, I was sat in an Indian restaurant in Cupertino, California, with one of Sun's lawyers, who was basically telling me about the case, asking me to help, and saying, and I turned to him, I said, because this was just after the DOJ case when they essentially snatched defeat from the jaws of victory, and I said to him, are you really going to see this through? Because if you bail out on this halfway through, then essentially it'll be a massive disappointment. You'll have just let everybody down. Be a waste of time. Is Scott McNeely really, going to see this through? And he said, oh, absolutely. It's a point of principle for Scott. Blah, 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 blah. Which just goes to show you never, ever believe. So I think it was like 2 or 3 years later when Sun basically took $2 billion to go away. I sent him an email saying, don't you remember that conversation we had? But I never got a reply. I mean, I just never got a reply.
Everything after the third martini doesn't count.
Yeah, but the thing is, what happened was, essentially, the little guys kept sticking at it. So the very first hearing, essentially, Volk and I turned up on behalf of the Samba team. And on every single case, every single hearing in the case, there's been either Volker, myself, Tridge, just, York, Carlo, just basically the little guys there saying, excuse me, we're trying to compete here. And one by one, the giants fell away, took the money and said, well, okay, I know competition's tough, but here's $2 billion and, goodbye, good luck. But we kept going and we won. At the end of the day, there's on the interoperability side, there was the Free Software Foundation Europe and the Samba team were the only two left standing. We were the only people still there. We saw it through, and what it goes to show is that if you persevere, even if things seem to be against you at the beginning, the little guys can win. The little guys can actually win. You can win in the law, even if it's, sort of a few anonymous people versus a large corporation. You can win, and you can win big. I know Carlo's right, there's still a lot more to be done, but I think we won big today. We won really big today.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. No, I mean, I agree with everything that was said, by this amazing team with which I've worked on this case, and I agree with the whole point about, this being a very interesting experience that was often fun, and in fact, today I had 6 of the most fun minutes of my life, I have to say. I thought
your face was going to split in half with a smile.
Yeah, I mean, it was, you had this mental image of, Brad Smith hitting this brick wall, This was the very first time that Microsoft has actually been stopped. The first time that the law has persevered over Microsoft. This is the very first time that actually a competition authority has seen this through to the end and prevailed in court against Microsoft. This is, unique. It's absolutely historic in that sense. So I think we do deserve a little bit of celebration.
It's the first time I've seen lawyers doing high fives to each of us.
Hugging each other.
Yeah, lawyers hugging each other. Can you imagine that? It was emotional.
To give credit to Brad Smith, he was very, very good at showing up at the press conference and giving a very, very sound speech just to...
Brad Smith is a gentleman.
Yes,
definitely a gentleman. I have a great deal of respect for him.
Yep.
He behaved impeccably throughout, the occasion, throughout all the occasions. He came over, he shook hands with everybody, he's been nothing but friendly with everyone. I can't say the same for his corporation, but Brad is a really nice guy.
That is usually true, actually, for most of the guys.
Yeah.
However, the way their company behaves, which they support, is not acceptable.
Yep.
And also war for the two top lawyers that were on records for Microsoft. Mr. Forrester and Mr. Belew are really, really top shot. And this is
No, in fact, this is very true. Yeah. I mean, you have one of the richest companies in the world. I mean, they have more money than God, almost.
Yes, and they have
the best lawyers.
People were scared of Forrester. The people were really scared of Mr. Forrester.
And for a reason.
One.
Yeah.
But they basically picked up the wrong party.
Well, it helps to have the facts on your side.
Well, I don't know which is the wrong party, because Microsoft pays big, so...
Yeah.
No, but the lesson here is the good guys can win, and
yes.
There's more work to do. This was round two of a couple more to come.
I think so.
However, we won the first two, and we can win the other ones as well.
Yeah, if we keep going, you know, the great thing about doing our job is that essentially it's easy because we don't have to spin anything. Really easy writing briefs when you just have to tell the truth about what you know. It must be really hard on the other side to write. I mean, those guys earn their money. They really must, because, you know, the amount of spin that has to go in on that side is incredible, whereas we just sit down and we say, well, we did this, and we asked for this, and, you know,
I couldn't do the same job.
Yeah, it would be a very hard job to do on the other side, I think.
Well, you know, speaking about some of the new frontiers, we all saw what happened with the ISO process for MSO XML. Do you guys think there's any plan or any interest in the European Commission in going after Microsoft on this? I know that they were waiting for the results of this decision before going further with some complaints.
Well, I mean, there is a complaint by the ESIS, the European Committee for Interoperable Systems, of November, I believe, last year, about Office and also Internet issues. And the Commission, to my knowledge, has not yet made a decision whether or not it will investigate that case. We, as FSFE, Samba, and OpenOffice.org, have already offered our technical expertise and input, as we've done for the previous case, to support that case. And we do hope they will start that investigation. We definitely hope they will do it. And we will stand by them as we've stood by them on this case as well. We think that it's absolutely necessary to end this sort of behavior in all areas. I mean, it's very important to understand that, I mean, we've been talking here about, you know, interoperability, the workgroup server market, the bundling for the real player, but that wasn't really our main concern. These are just two areas of many areas in which Microsoft exhibits the exact same behavior. Now, you know, the court has today said this is unacceptable, but this is not only unacceptable in those two areas, it's unacceptable in all areas. So...
Because what they do is very, very effective. I mean, the thing to remember is, you know, yes, we won in court, but essentially we're losing in the marketplace. Between the beginning of the case and now, I think the desktop monopoly went down from, I think it was 97% to 92%, and these are figures from the seven states California group
right,
who filed to the DOJ.
The rogue states.
Yeah, the rogue states, as it were. But the workgroup server market has gone from, I think it was either 40% or 45%, I'd have to look, Microsoft. It's now 70% Microsoft. So if you look at things like, you know, Active Directory, Exchange servers, they are steamrolling that market. It's at the tipping point where if something isn't done, if this information isn't released and competitive products can be created, they will own that market with a monopoly the same as the desktops, completely.
I remember not so long ago, only 12 or 13 years ago, that... you know, if you couldn't run a NetBUI protocol on your PC to connect to Novell servers, you couldn't do anything.
That was IPX.
Yeah, sorry, you're getting the engineers.
See, maybe it's that far ago that, you know, I get mixed up. NetBUI was the Microsoft protocol.
Right.
So and IPX was...
Windows 4 Workgroups was
NetBUI. Windows 4 Workgroups
was NetBUI. And OS2 was NetBUI.
And OS2 was NetBUI.
So one of the lawyers... I was listening to one of the lawyers briefing the press after the case, and he came up with a very, very important... point. Some of the Microsoft people on the case and the Microsoft supporters on the case, I think it was specifically ACT, were saying, oh, this is terrible, this punishes innovation in Europe, and companies now will be frightened that if they are innovative and successful that the EU will take their innovations away. And so one of the commission lawyers and the lawyers on the supporters on our side of the case. He basically said, look, he said, if you think about any of these markets, who were the innovators? Nivelle was the innovator. Nivelle created single-handedly the workgroup server market. It was taken away from them by the monopoly.
And Real,
yeah, created the streaming media. You know, innovated and created the streaming media market. And they're gone now. I mean, nobody uses Real. Very few.
And Netscape invented the browser game.
Yeah.
And they was
they were annihilated. Yeah.
Yes,
so it's
important to say streaming media, because in Microsoft's communications, they like to talk about all media players together, such as, you know, iTunes, QuickTime. Whereas it's really the streaming media market that was killed off by Microsoft, Windows Media Player.
So market definitions have been a really interesting part of the case. So if anyone is interested in looking at the documents, some of the biggest arguments in the case have been about what is the definition of a market? What is a workgroup server market? Does it exist? You know, what is a streaming media market? And it's that they're very technical legally, but if people are interested, I would recommend them to read the actual arguments aren't as bad as you might think in terms of reading the documents, because they're written for lawyers, not engineers, and so they're actually quite open to the layperson if you want to just read a lot of the briefs. They're really interesting.
Okay, a last question for Carlo. Now, I keep hearing all the time about Article 82. And it seems that everybody in Europe who's interested in Article 82, which I think concerns competition...
It's abuse of dominant position.
Of dominant position. Well, it seems that everyone who's interested in that part of law has been watching this case under a microscope. In fact, it seems that there was a big meeting in Italy perhaps a week or two ago, in which some changes in the Article 82... were claimed by the European Commission to be postponed until the result of the Microsoft case was known. Can you tell us a little bit about how that European law is?
Well, antitrust law is very short part of the European treaties, and it's made basically on court law. So this very provision is about company becoming dominant and abusing the dominance. There is nothing wrong even to achieve monopoly, but from great power comes great responsibility. So if you get to monopoly, you must be very cautious. You're not just a layman. You are somebody who can control the market and make the market fail. So it's all about ensuring that the market works, so the competitor can show up and challenge your dominance. Today, with the technological lock-in, the market power, Microsoft makes sure that nobody can get to its position or to even get a good chunk out of it. So the law is about opening the competition. That's it. It's simple. It's not that complicated. It's not stealing secrets or whatever. It's not abusing great power.
So one last thing I want to say, if I can get in,
sure,
is that to people who haven't been in the courtroom, we had a real treat, because it was a European courtroom, so all the lawyers wore their formal robes. So there was everyone there. There were people from Scotland. There were various people from, you know, Germany and France, all wearing their legal robes. But I'll tell you something. Nobody, absolutely nobody, looks as sharp as an Italian lawyer in formal robes. you know, I mean, the other guys, they've got their robes on, the wigs and whatever, and then Carlo puts on his robes, and it's like, wow, that's style.
Well, how can you argue with a guy who quotes Dante on the page of his plan?
Thank you. You noticed that.
I hope there are some pictures. I hope people get to see some of the coverage, right? Because, man, you got to see those silver epaulets. They're just, wow, I was so impressed.
Well, thank you so much.
Hire Italian lawyers for this.
Yeah, they have the best robes. So.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much to all of you, and I think that you've deserved a rest and a celebration for today. Maybe work will start again tomorrow, but today's a day for celebration.
We're already fixing Samba Bugs. While we're in the hotel room, we're already fixing Samba Bugs because it's always broken. But I think we'll probably go out and get very, very drunk tonight. We would have got very drunk tonight even if we lost, but now we're going to be happy drunk, not miserable drunk.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.